Expenses, the Criminal Law and Procedure Committee, Wednesday, April 14th, 1971, 3 p.m., Room 315, State Capitol Building. Today's agenda, House Bills 1003, 1004, 1125, and 1331.
Turnover, Abby, I keep forgetting, well, please come to order, and I think we'll note those that are absent. We do not have a forum, but we're going to start taking testimony.
We got all these
House Bills, 1004.
We got three of those three.
Attorney General Lee Johnson. I asked that we take four first.
Four. I see. The boss gets in first, is that it? Sorry about that, Jay. Oh, by golly, right.
That always remarks the end of the minute.
Chairman, House Bill 1004 is a witness immunity law similar to that that's been adopted in 40 other states and the federal government. The law provides in any criminal proceeding, court upon motion, the district attorney may compel a witness to testify. The witness has previously refused on the grounds that he may be incriminated. The witness who is ordered to testify under the bill, according to Section 2, quote, shall not be prosecuted or subjected to any penalty or forfeiture for or on account of any fact or act concerning which, in accordance with the order, he is required to testify or produce evidence. House Bill 1004 is premised on the fundamental policy of the law that every citizen has a duty to testify and produce evidence. The only exception is where the testimony would violate the citizen's right against self-incrimination or is otherwise privileged. House Bill 1004 protects these privileges by granting immunity. There is considerable need throughout law enforcement for this type of immunity law. Prosecutors and other law enforcement agencies are increasingly faced with the problem of witnesses claiming the right against self-incrimination. In many instances, this claim of privilege is invalid, or the witness simply does not desire to testify. In other instances, the claim of the privilege may only have some remote connection to incrimination. Of course, once the privilege is claimed, there is no way for the prosecutor or the court to determine whether or not the witness has validly claimed the privilege. An immunity statute is also very important in dealing with sophisticated and organized crime. Oftentimes, the only successful prosecution can be conducted against the higher echelon is through the use of an immunity law. This is particularly true in the area of drug abuse offenses. It is generally agreed that law enforcement should focus its efforts in the area of drug abuse against the professional pusher. However, if we're going to make this the focus of law enforcement, then they must have the tools with which they can effectively operate. The arguments that have been advanced in opposition to House Bill 1004 are, one, that it's of questionable constitutionality. Testimonial compulsion statutes are based upon two different types of immunity, the so-called use immunity and transactional immunity. Use immunity statutes prohibit the use of the testimony in any way by the immunity granting sovereign. Transactional immunity statutes prohibit the immunity granting sovereign from prosecuting for crimes which are the subject matter of the testimony. House Bill 1004 provides for a transactional type of immunity. Use immunity statutes have recently been brought into question. The transactional type, however, have been repeatedly upheld by the United States Supreme Court, beginning with Councilman versus Hitchcock, which was decided in 1892. A more recent case is Murphy versus Waterfront Commission, which was decided in 1954. The second question that is raised is, if a witness is compelled to testify in a state proceeding, the state immunity does not extend to the federal proceeding. The law is well established that where the state has granted immunity, the federal government is barred from using the compelled testimony or any lien from it in support of a federal investigation or prosecution. Furthermore, if the federal government does prosecute, it would have the burden of proving affirmatively that the investigation was completely independent of such testimony. And I cite to you, again, Murphy versus Waterfront Commission. I've also, in my statement, you have the quotation of the law, so I think it's probably as clear a statement as you can get. The third question that's raised is the question of whether the prosecutor should grant immunity to a witness who should, as a matter of public policy, be prosecuted. I think the answer to this is that the prosecutor always has the discretion as to when he is going to prosecute. In fact, as a practical matter, prosecutors often do grant immunity in order to obtain evidence. House Bill 1004, of course, provides a legal basis for the immunity. It likewise protects from the abuse by the prosecutor by making it a matter for the court's discretion. Section 1 provides that the court shall order the witness to testify as requested by the district attorney, quote, unless the court finds that the detail would be clearly contrary to the public interest. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I don't know why the district attorney got a red mark on it or not, but contrary to the public interest, that was the last one you said. What about the interest of the person who's before the bar? Does the rest of the bill fully protect him so you don't have to prove his interest there?
Well, you protect him by granting him immunity, Senator Hoyt. And again, as I said, the general policy of the law in our society that every individual does have a duty to testify, and the only exception to that is where his testimony is subject to a privilege. And of course, if it's a privilege, one of the other privileges, such as the attorney-client privilege or the doctor-patient, that is not an issue in this matter. But here, this deals only with the privilege against self-incrimination, but he cannot be incriminated because he cannot be prosecuted once he's testified.
Mm-hmm. So, in your view, this then fully complies with the opinion?
I don't think there's any question. These statutes have been upheld time and time again. As I said, there's 40 other states that have similar statutes. This particular bill was modeled after California law. The federal government has used immunity statutes for years.
Any other questions? Not thank you. I'd like to read into the record communication received this afternoon. Mr. Barton, Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, called to advise that Mr. Connell, Multnomah County District Attorney, has planned to appear on behalf of House Bill 1004, but it is necessary that he be out of the state today. Mr. Connell would like the record to show that HB 1004 has endorsement of his office. It is considered critical as far as prosecution is concerned. Lieutenant Skelton.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Keith Skelton. I'm a member of the House of Representatives. I'm a member of the Judiciary Committee. This bill was in our Judiciary Committee. I voted against the Judiciary Committee, and I spoke and voted against it on the floor. Let me give you some of my reasoning behind this. This bill attacks with the protections of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. And the protections of the Oregon State Constitution that says no person shall be compelled in any criminal prosecution to testify against himself. Where does the Fifth Amendment come from? It comes out of the transition of our system of justice from the inquisitory system of justice to the accusatory system of justice. The inquisitory system of justice was in existence and in use both on the continent and in the British court until 1500 and 1600. Under the inquisitory system of justice, a witness or an accused would be forced to answer questions put to him. He would be forced either in the torture or in the threat or something of this kind. I meant to bring along with me a book called Lord Coke, in his life. It's a very dramatic story of the times in which he lived, and it has something to do with the development of the Fifth Amendment. The use of the Star Chamber proceedings, and the Star Chamber in Britain and England was so called because the state, because it was shaped like a star. The Star Chamber proceedings of torture and forcing the accused to confess or to, if they're not accused of anything, of forcing them to talk, in other words, and all kinds of devices to use to confess and talk. We moved gradually from that barbaric system into the accusatory system which we have now, where the state is put on the burden of accusing and then proving their case. What the Attorney General wants to do with this particular bill is move back away into the accusatory system of justice. I understand the intrigency of which he speaks. But I contend, gentlemen, that our constitutional rights are too important to be violated by temporary expedients. And I want to suggest to you that this is a temporary expedient which has been a very, very bad practice. The Attorney General says that this is in effect in several other states, 40 other states, and I have not checked these figures. I assume that this is correct. That doesn't mean the state of Oregon has to follow this particular objective or this particular route. After all, those 40 other states can be wrong, and the state of Oregon can be right. On the other hand, they don't have to be wrong, and we don't have to be wrong either. We don't have to judge it in that way. We are in our own state, and we are entitled to make our own laws the way we see fit. And I contend that the crime wave in the state of Oregon has not gotten to the place where we need to start. There are two questions that you have to answer for yourself. First of all, you have to answer the question of policy. Is this something that the state of Oregon wants to do? Are we going to be proud of ourselves for putting this kind of thing into law? If you were one of the men who was brought out of the state legislature that made up the United States Constitution, what would you say to something like this when some attorney came along to you, an enforcement attorney, whatever you call them in those days, a prosecutor, and said, "We need this kind of thing so we can get the criminal"? Would you have watered down the Fifth Amendment when you were writing it to do this? And I think any words today. What particular things are that we need this today after 180 years of constitutional history? Now, so this is the first thing you have to do. This one is to make your mind up on the question of policy. How does it work? Well, this is the way it works. You have a witness and you want him to testify. He says, "I refuse to testify on the grounds that my testimony is intended to incriminate me." You say, if you are the prosecutor, you're saying, "We need your testimony so badly that we are going to allow you to take a bath. And we are going to grant you immunity, and then we want you to testify." The witness says, "I don't want to testify. I am frightened of testifying." Or he says, "I refuse to testify anyway. I don't believe you have any right to question me." Or, "I refuse to testify, period." So then what are you going to do to us? Well, we're civilized today, see. We just put them in jail. We don't put the Chinese boot on him. And we don't put him on the rack, we just put him in jail. After a while, we let him out of jail long enough to get to the district attorney. And he says, have you liked jail so well as you would like to testify by this time? And he says, "No, I'm not going to testify." "Okay, you're in contempt, back to jail." Now this is what the bill does. And if that isn't a violation of your Fifth Amendment rights, I don't doubt what the Attorney General has said about it being constitutional in some areas, and I will speak to that in a minute. But I suggest to you that sending a person to jail for asserting his constitutional rights is a violation of the Fifth Amendment privilege, even though you statutorily allowed him to take a bath. So what do you do? So that's the first thing that comes out of that. You get punishment for a person who asserts his Fifth Amendment rights. Punishment. The second thing you do is you give to the courts and the district attorney certain control over human behavior, which they cannot do now. In other words, you move and you include the authorities in justice. The third problem with this is that it is unenforceable except by force. You cannot enforce it unless you use force. If he says, I won't testify, you grab him by the back of the neck and you say, talk, you. He says, I won't testify. You've been given the privilege. So you say to him, you've been given the right to testify and you'll be protected. We will see if you're protected and so on and so forth. Talk. He says, God, still says, I won't talk. So what are you going to do? Maybe perhaps we can whip him a little bit. Or something like this. What exactly are you going to do for him to force him to talk? These are the problems that I see in this case. Now, this is the policy question. There are some more things that you have to look at regarding the policy question. Representative McPherson, who carried the bill on the floor of the House, said, look at the Manson case. How would they have ever broken the Manson case if they hadn't given immunity to Linda Cattaglia? Let me ask you this question. Suppose the person may have chosen to give immunity to you because he was the only person who talked with Matson. Do you think that district attorney down there would have taken that chance? Sure he would. He would have given his left arm, clear up to the elbow, to prosecute some of those people successfully, and if Matson had to be the one, he would have taken Matson too. Or he would have taken Matson instead of Libby, instead of Linda. If Matson was the one who decided he wanted to take. So this is another problem. Which one of the bunch, if you were trying to use one of a bunch of co-conspirators to get at the other one, which one are you going to use? Are you going to use the worst one or the best one? Are you going to use the one who masterminded it? Are you going to give little talk? The judge says, how close you are to election. And how hungry the judge is going to be. Because this is a like all the rest of us, they're political animals. And one of the ways in which they run for office is by good prosecution. Not long ago, we noticed the death, the death of one of the great prosecutors in the United States. He became a candidate for president of the United States. And one of the more new ways in which he became a candidate for president of the United States is because of his. He was renowned as a criminal hunter and he was prosecuted. So district attorneys are, and rightfully so, I'm not impugning them a bit when I say that they are politically oriented just like we are. They get their fame, notoriety, and prosecution. Now, these are the questions that you have to look at regarding policy. Now, the constitutional question. I had handed to me just this morning, and I haven't had an opportunity to research it yet, a sheet out of the Criminal Law Reporter for February 10th. I'm sure that this is available over in the law library. A case in the United States District Court of Southern New York, as it has held the witness immunity provision of the 1970 Organized Crime Control Act unconstitutional. I recognize that this is a federal district court, and they're dealing with the federal act. But nevertheless, there is this question now that's been raised as to whether or not the provisions of the Crime Control Act are similar to the provisions of this act. I don't know whether they are or not. There's something that we should set for you.
The 40 other states have similar laws. Causes me to wonder if the same discussion that is being held here today wasn't presented to the legislatures of those states.
I
would certainly think so.
I don't know. I agree with you. I don't think we're unique out here. And yet, on the other hand, I think both of us, Senator, have been around the legislative process long enough, and have compared us with other legislatures long enough, to realize that in many areas, other legislatures are wanting. And they do not examine questions many times in the same thoroughness.
Well, I think that's speculation. I don't think that you can say that at all.
Well, I think that's just
I think we have to assume the opposite, that they are just as deliberate and as sincere as we are.
Well,
I think that would be the only assumption you can make. But
the reason why I talk to you about policy.
Yeah. I think that you've got something there. Number one is constitutionality. Now, the Attorney General's statement here indicates that judgment, and according to the research that his office has conducted, that it is constitutional. That's number one.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing I think is a basic fundamental issue as to whether or not you feel that there is a sufficient encroachment upon the liberty of an individual as against the right of the state and society as a whole, not the individual, involves all of society, whether or not they should have the implements that are necessary, perhaps, to detect crime and to apprehend the criminal. That's the basic decision that we have to make. And if we were convinced that this was unconstitutional, I don't think there would be any question whatever. We would have to say, no, we have to go along with the right of the individual. On the other hand, if it is constitutional, and if 40 states have adopted it, as well as the federal government, then I think the issue before us is somewhat different. At that point, the issue is this. Although it is constitutional to do this, should we deprive the individual of this right, as against the right of society to be protected from the type of act that this individual is or may commit? Don't you think that's the issue?
That's why I talked to you in terms of first policy and then the constitutionality question. Now, the case that I, this particular citation out of the criminal law of the court, says that the Councilman case and the Murphy case, which to which the Attorney General alluded, are children law in their particular narrow, restricted frame of reference. I'm going to have this case researched and interpreted for me, and I'll be back to give this to you.
I think that's, I would be interested in seeing that.
But this is the narrow question of the constitutionality. Now, the next question that you raise, the question of policy, as I say, I suggest that the visitor thing is justified. Now, let me ask you this, or let me make this remark. The men who wrote the Fifth Amendment were in a lot less secure society than we are today. At the time the Fifth Amendment was written by our forefathers, they were in a society where they were fighting for their lives and their fortunes and their sacred honors. And they didn't know whether this country was in the last 5 years or 10 years or what was going to happen. And yet they had enough faith in the protection that they thought were needed by the Fifth Amendment. And the Fifth Amendment comes out of the British common law. They had enough protection, and they had enough faith in those protections to write it unqualifiedly into the Constitution.
That's true, but the 40 states that have adopted it, their society is as secure as ours, and yet they haven't. I agree with you. This isn't like a sales tax.
But this is the thing that you've got to decide. You've got to decide whether you feel so threatened in your life that you want to take a piece of the Fifth Amendment away, because I don't think you can deny it if it says it's a certain thing.
That's the thing that we have to determine. But on the constitutional question, whether it does take away a piece of
it. It does actually, whether the court recognizes it's constitutional. Yeah.
Senator, what's the purpose, Keith, as you see it, of the Fifth Amendment? What I'm leading up to is you gave examples of fear and threats and so on, which go on right now. You know, a lot of people would like to say, I don't want to testify, not because I may be convicted, but somebody's going to beat me up or recrimination or whatever it may be. They have no protection now in our federal law. That's just tough apples. So my question is, what is the, as you see it in history or in philosophy or in policy, if you will, what is the purpose of the Fifth?
Let me see if I've got... Yes, here we are. This comes from a little book called The Fifth Amendment Today by Griswold, who at the time he wrote it was the president of Yale Law School. I'll leave this to the history a little bit. It seems quite clear that we owe the privilege today primarily to Swedenborg John Lillehammer. He was a cantankerous person, a short to whom we owe much for many of our basic rights. One of his contemporaries said that if all the world was emptied of all but John Lilleburn, Lilleburn would quarrel with John and John with Lilleburn. Like most contentious persons, he was stubborn. In 1637, he was hailed before the Star Chamber on a charge of having imported certain heretical and seditious books. He refused to take the oath to answer truly, and the Council of State Star Chamber condemned him to be whipped and pilloried for his boldness in refusing to take a legal oath, without which many offenses may go undiscovered and unpunished. And in 1638, the sentence was carried out. But Lilleburn persisted. He filed a petition in Parliament, and in 1641, the House of Commons voted that the sentence was illegal and against the liberty of the subject. Later, the House of Lords concurred with this view, ordered an indemnity paid to them of £3,000, which is a very large sum in those days. Now, here is a man who simply didn't want to testify. Why he didn't want to testify is beside the point. That's none of the state's business.
Well, we don't have that law now.
No. But nevertheless, you will have it.
Well, we don't have any protection on that now. I have no rights if I don't want to testify. I've got no protection now.
But if you are accused of crime, you are.
Well, yeah, but what I'm getting at, isn't it because if I'm committing myself, in other words, I am testifying, and the crux of the matter is that if I'm required to talk, I build the prosecution's case, the Inquisition. I'm the only witness I have to tell. And I go to jail for it. But if you say, no matter what you say, Mr. Carson, you're not going to go to jail. Now, all we're talking about is the privilege to keep my mouth shut.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the basis of the argument. It's not going to jail, because that's not an issue. It's just a privilege of whether the Fifth Amendment is designed is to allow me the right, when I'm charged with a crime, to shut up.
Mm-hmm.
A right that we don't have in any other aspect of our law.
Well, in answer to your question, this is precisely what the Fifth Amendment is for. It is to keep the government from moving into the inquisitory system of justice.
You think even though we grant the immunity, which is different from the history did not grant the immunity, that's the Inquisition,
yes.
You one, required to testify, and two, you have hooked for it.
But the thing I'm trying to say to you, Senator, is that if you pass this bill, that's what you're going to have.
You think you just move it right toward it then?
This is what you have. You have a man or somebody before the district attorney. The district attorney says, the game can be a unit. You want to know, want to give it. All you know about this operation. This guy says to himself, if I tell these people about this operation, when I get out of here, I'm going to be killed. And so,
well, that's the only factor that is different. Now, you certainly won't contend that in a civil case that a witness who is subpoenaed and refuse to testify.
No.
Because it's nobody's business what he knows.
Well, this is not a fight.
Well, that's
criminal.
True, but the analogy is present. Well, in this, if immunity is granted, he has nothing to fear from the state. He has nothing to fear about being prosecuted by the state. The only difference between if this bill passes and the present law, the only difference is this, that if he refuses to testify in a criminal action on the ground that it tends to incriminate him, then he has the fear of what other criminals or accomplices or co-conspirators may do to him. That's the only thing. The question is whether that is to make certain that will not happen to him, as against society's right to commit or crime.
A privilege that a witness would not have.
But this is also offensive to an individual. Now let's say that one of the favorite things they prosecute attorneys for these days is IRS. Let's say that you are investigated by the IRS, and that they have to be testified for a grand jury. And they say, I don't want to testify.
On the ground that it may tend to incriminate.
Let's say that they're in a partnership. And if you just don't want to testify with reference to, let's say, that one of the other partners is implicated in something like that, and you just don't want to get into this particular area, you claim the Fifth Amendment, so the DA says, well, we'll give you a bath, and you've been abused by the Fifth Amendment. Well, now, are you going to report the Fifth Amendment?
Well, you wouldn't if it's still.
Well, or else. On the other hand, suppose you are innocent of this wrongdoing, but you know that your partner is guilty, but you have a deep respect for him, and you don't want him to be convicted out of the words of your mouth. You were brought in and asked to testify for a grand jury.
You have to.
Of course you would.
Today.
Well, you would have to unless they accuse you.
Yeah.
But let's say that they accuse you, you are innocent and you've included.
But aren't you arguing that the Fifth Amendment, the protection really extends to third parties then, isn't that?
It extends to both guilty and innocent persons who are being asked to.
Yeah, but what you're saying, the examples you've given is where the concern is the protection they'll offer to the. What I'm getting at is the contention has been made by the Attorney General that this is an offset. This provides immunity to check the bad part, if you will, of giving up the Fifth. Your example now talks about other collateral problems, which I grant you could exist, but they exist today. And I don't think the Fifth Amendment, my own personal judgment, is to allow me to avoid testifying against Tony. I don't see that as the present protection of fair. I don't think I'd get away with it.
Let me ask you this, and let me pose this question to you. Why don't you give every person here the truth serum?
Well, why
don't you pass a bill saying that they must be given certain pentothal? Or why don't you pass a bill saying that they must be given a lie detector?
Well, it would be just as important to do that in a civil case as in a criminal case.
Well, let's put it in context with
everyone.
Let's say you put some further amendments on the bill, and you say, in addition to being added a immunity, each witness shall be given for requested to undergo a 16 anesthetic or a lie detector. In other words, when he talks, he's testing to show that he's telling the truth.
Would you accept such an easement to the bill?
But doesn't that go to the question of truth, and that's not involved? I mean, it's no more involved in this than any other litigation we're talking about. That's a perjury problem, isn't it, Steve?
Yes, I suppose it is. Let's say that you've got a witness who is accused of one kind of crime, and that if he is, and that he necessarily, if he talks about this, and is going to include himself in another.
That's the same problem. It may tend to incriminate me, not of this crime necessarily, but of something else.
All right. So he's required to testify.
But he's granted immunity.
No, he's only granted immunity for one crime. He's not granted immunity for every crime he's ever committed.
He's granted immunity for every crime which may be disclosed by reason of the testimony which he gives. If I read the bill correctly.
For or on account of any fact or act concerning which, in accordance with the order he was required to testify, I produce evidence. Okay. Now you bring him in and you say we want you to testify. We are accusing you of this, and we want you to testify about this. Let's say that his testimony is inextricably tied up with some other kind of crime. I contend that he can be convicted of the other crime.
I don't think so, because it was that fact. Or that
suppose his testimony produces leads.
Well, that could be clarified if that's your only fear.
If it produces leads to other criminal activities, how about that?
On his part,
yeah.
I think even that would be acceptable.
I don't see how that's been resisted, though.
Well, not as to leads,
no.
But certainly as to if the facts concerning which he testified, if you were to testify concerning these particular facts,
okay.
And he does. And in doing so, he discloses that he is guilty of some other offense, some other crime. He is as fully protected from prosecution for those other crimes as he is for the
particular
crime.
I don't believe it.
Well, I think that could certainly be clarified very easily.
And not only that, as I say, I think it is the
Well, Mr. Chairman, on line 16, where it says, or on account of any fact or act, I think that means me.
It may be me. But if it isn't, I think that it should be clarified.
Well, I should stick up in the Fifth Amendment right now. I wouldn't want to do violence to it in any sense of the word, but I don't see how it's there. If this needs clarifying, well, I'd still like to put the right language.
Well, anyway, those are my thoughts on it.
Do you have any suggestions about how to eliminate the least part of this over the above prison?
I don't even want to.
Very clear. There is a Keith Skelton amendment to the.
That's the thing I told.
I would like to see
Keith's research on this constitutionality, because he may have a valid point there, and if it is unconstitutional, I don't think we should pursue it any farther.
Right. Well,
you refer to it.
Or you may have to amend it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam?
William Snowford. Did I pronounce that right?
Almost.
Snowford. That's close enough for me. Better than I used to be. Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Snowford. I'm an attorney from Portland, the former district attorney, deputy district attorney in Monmouth County. Member of the American Civil Liberties Union. I'm here speaking this afternoon on behalf of the ACLU in opposition to House Bill 1004. For the reasons that I've stated in the statement which is coming around, paragraph 1, the bill does not, in the state of Oregon, cannot grant full and complete immunity from all prosecution which might result from compelled testimony. Without such full immunity, compelled testimony violates the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. And then the quotation from the United States Supreme Court in the Albertson case says, in Councilman versus Hitchcock, the court held that an immunity statute is valid only if it supplies a complete protection from all the perils against which constitutional prohibition was designed to guard. I might say that the Councilman case then went on to say that the immunity statute had to afford absolute immunity against future prosecution for the offense to which the question relates. In other words, the councilman said that there just has to be no prosecution resulting from the compelled testimony. Paragraph 2, unless immunity statute provides complete protection from prosecution for any aspect of the transaction about which the testimony is compelled,
statute is constitutionally defective. And this is the citation to the case that Representative Skelton referred to, decision of the Southern District of New York, January 29, 1971. That decision struck down the very recently enacted immunity provisions of the Federal Organized Crime Control Act. I could just read very briefly from that opinion. This is Judge Motley. He said, this court holds that councilman is still the law, that it has not been silentio, overruled, or eroded by more recent opinions, that transactional immunity is constitutionally required as between the questioning sovereign and the witness, and that the immunity statute here challenged is consequently unconstitutional, because that particular federal statute said or referred only to use rather than to the transactional aspect of the statute. Paragraph 3, there are cases now pending in the United States Supreme Court which may clarify the authority of states to compel testimony. Since there is no really compelling or urgent need for this legislation, House Bill 1004, this bill should be tabled pending such clarification. I might add here also, I believe that it's my understanding that the Criminal Law Revision Commission is undertaking to study the criminal procedure statutes of this state and to write a new code governing this aspect of the criminal law. And I feel that this statute that we're talking about today is the legal type of statute that should be studied in depth by the Criminal Law Revision Commission rather than being enacted in the present form that it's in now. As to my assertion that there's no really compelling or urgent need for the legislation, I believe it would be very difficult to really prove it one way or the other. I don't think there are any statistics that, that are presently available, or at least that law enforcement agencies would be willing to make available to us to clarify this. But I can give you an example of a case that I'm presently defending in one of the counties in the state involving three individuals who are accused of planting a bomb. Two of them have been indicted. The third individual's name appears at the bottom of the indictment. He gave testimony before the grand jury. He was not indicted. And he will not be indicted, because the district attorney has no intention whatsoever of pressing any charges against that third individual. And the grand jury is not going to indict a man that they know will give material evidence against the two when their case is coming to trial. So, my point is that the DA has immunity now. Not technically, but informally, he can grant immunity if he needs it for his case. So my point is not, I'm not really passing judgment on whether that's correct or whether that's incorrect. I'm just saying that there are means available to get testimony when the DA really needs it. Therefore, this statute is not really so urgent or so pressing that it needs to be enacted. I think it ought to be referred to the Criminal Law Revision Commission study. Finally, paragraph 4, the bill is ambiguous and not defining what is meant by the term public interest. The term should be defined so the judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and compel witnesses know what is intended. Ambiguity fosters abuse and litigation, neither of which is desirable in view of today's crowded criminal docket.
Any questions?
Ignoring for a moment the cases that are pending in the Supreme Court. If the, in accordance with the councilman case, complete immunity was given in this statute, and if the term public interest were defined satisfactorily to you, would the ACLU then find the bill acceptable?
Well, Senator, I don't know what future decision or position the ACLU might take if it were so amended. Basically, the views that you have here are my views. I personally believe that if these amendments we've talked about are taken care of, that the statute still is not completely equivalent to the Fifth Amendment privilege. For this reason, take a situation where a witness is brought in on a car theft situation and admits possession of a stolen car.
and there are two or three confederates or something of that sort, and he testifies against them, and they therefore are indicted for possession of a stolen motor vehicle or something of that sort. But it's also clear that the motor vehicle came from California. What's to prevent the federal government from slapping this guy with the Dyer Act charge?
Well, that's true, but I was thinking particularly of cases where no federal question is involved. I noticed at the top of your statement that the American Civil Liberties Union, are you speaking for them today, or you are? Your answer to my question was then that it would not be acceptable. You don't know whether it would be acceptable to them. Would it be acceptable to you?
No, sir.
Next question. With reference to the term public interest, don't we have case law and also statutes that use that term, particularly the Public Utilities Commission laws and also in the Interstate Commerce Commission? I see over and over again that a permit will not be issued unless certain findings are made and it is in the public interest.
Yes, Senator, I agree that the term public interest is used quite frequently in many other situations, but we are talking about the criminal law. Criminal statutes have to be designed with very much more rigorous
guidance. I agree. Would you have any
proposed definitions?
Suggestions that you...
I'd have to think about it a while. I don't have any proposed definitions that I might suggest to you.
Do you think that it is possible to provide any definition of public interest which would be acceptable to you?
Well, one of the problems is, now, as Attorney General has mentioned, I didn't know until today that this was modeled after the California Act. There may be some California cases that talk about this. I don't know. I would like to look at some of the other legislation and see whether or not public interest is defined in some of the other statutes, and if it is, then perhaps it should be copied and adopted. It's hard to know, reading the statute, just precisely what the drafters of the legislation had in mind when they meant public interest. And I'm not sure that my conception of public interest would match theirs. I'm not as convinced as the Attorney General is that this legislation as it is now is the transactional kind of immunity as opposed to the use immunity. It says any fact or act concerning which he's required to testify. If you have a situation where, say, there are a gang of robbers that go in and hold up at a grocery store, and the evidence is clear that three of them came in, three of them left with the proceeds, and they get one, and they say, okay, we'll give you immunity if you tell on your buddies, and we won't prosecute you. So he goes ahead and testifies. Can you really say beyond any question of a doubt that this particular bill prevents the DA from turning around and charging him with receiving and concealing stolen property, for example? Kind of a lesser charge. It's fairly clear they can't charge him for robbery, but I'm not certain about the other part. And this is what we're talking about.
Is something that, if it isn't adequately clear, it can be clarified.
Eventually, yes.
I don't mean eventually. I mean in the language of the statute itself. That's the conversation we had with Representative Skelton.
Yes.
Would it be too much of an imposition, sir, if you were to, I hate to ask you this, but to conduct some research with respect to California cases and see what they say concerning public interest?
I'd be happy to.
I'd like to. You might also go into constitutionality if you would, because that's, I think, a really important thing.
Well, I'm saying, Senator, that our position is the American Civil Liberties Union position, and my own personal belief that this particular legislation as drafted is in violation of the Fifth Amendment. And the one case I said there are two cases pending in the Supreme Court, one of them quite clearly is going to discuss the whole area of just exactly how far a state can go. Whether or not some other states can use evidence that is gleaned or learned as a result of the testimony and so forth. And it looks as though, from the way the court has taken the questions that it's choosing to consider, that they're going to write a fairly definitive opinion in this area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jake Kansas, last witness down. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hadn't planned to testify on this bill, but it was one of the things that Representative Skelton said, and then Mrs. Knopper mentioned that I did want to enlarge upon it. First of all, both referred specifically to this recent case from New York, which calls into question the validity on which the district judge, trial judge, did declare the immunity provision of the New Organized Crime Act to be invalid. And I think that is the same case that the Attorney General referred to in his testimony without naming it or going into any detail. I think perhaps he should go into slight detail since there's been a question, maybe I can throw out some names for those who may be interested. As all the witnesses acknowledge, the immunity bill generally has always been upheld, and most recently by the U.S. Supreme Court in Murphy versus Waterfront Commission, an opinion by Goldberg, there is hardly a conservative court. And lately, there has been some thinking that perhaps the youth type immunity statute may not be constitutional because, as I've explained, they do not preclude prosecution, they simply preclude use of the testimony or the lead therefrom. The youth immunity statute is one similar to our present ORS 496.710, which grants youth type immunity in gaming violations. Mr. Wallace was trying to point that out to me as we were sitting here today. Now, as opposed to a transactional immunity statute, such as ORS 167.520.
What is
the gambling statute? The difference is this. A youth immunity statute, the state having compelled the testimony, is precluded from using that testimony in any way in evidence against the man or leads from it. And they must come in affirmatively and show that they did not build their case. If they charge them with something he testified about, and come in and show that they didn't use that as in a transactional immunity under that statute, the state is precluded from prosecuting him for anything which he testifies about, which is responsive to the question. And he cannot end the question with, by the way, I killed my wife last night. And grand union, you have to be within the scope of the question. So that's the difference. One precludes use, one precludes prosecution for the transaction. And as I say, we have an example of each in Oregon, and we've never had trouble from them, but then they're not frequently employed either. Okay. The U.S. Supreme Court granted certiorari in a youth immunity case very recently. The name of that case is Piccirillo versus New York, and it is reported at 8 Criminal Law Reporter 3081. I'm not sure if it's in the reports yet or not, very recent. In that case, the court granted certiorari in order to examine the youth immunity statute, and at argument time, they discovered that due to interpretation and such by the New York court, it was actually applied as a transactional immunity statute would be. I read this a long time ago, but that's my understanding of my memory. And so, instead of deciding the case, they dismissed it under their procedure, saying that the writ of certiorari had been improvidently granted. In other words, there's nothing really here of substance to look at. I think Justice Douglas or one of them descended from that. But what it really does is reaffirm the validity of the other type of statute, the transactional type of statute. But at about the same time, the New York trial court refused to enforce the new immunity provision of the Organized Crime Act, which is a youth immunity statute. And the name of that case is In Re Kinoy's testimony, K-I-N-O-Y, and it's reported as 8 Criminal Law Reporter 2327. I don't know if it's reported in the Fed. So, contrary to it, New Jersey case in the Zicarelli at 261 Atlantic 2nd, 129-1970. So when we say that there may be some doubt about use statutes, what we're really saying is the Supreme Court's interested in it, and we're saying that one trial judge in New York thinks that it's unconstitutional. But in any event, our statute says the witness shall not be prosecuted or subjected to any penalty or forfeiture for or on account of any fact or act concerning which, in accordance with the order, he is required to testify to these evidence. It's clearly a transactional matter, and it also, Murphy versus Waterfront would require that it be interpreted to refer as well to lease. So I don't think amendment is even necessary. I was a little taken aback with the reference to the political district attorney who prosecutes for whether the campaign kind of left or some such thing. He said district attorneys are just like us, they do that sort of thing. That's us referring to you, not to me. And
I thought you were trying to tell us, at least
on behalf of the district attorneys, I would say that's incorrect.
Is that your fault or the Oregon electorate?
I'm a great faith in the Oregon electorate.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Snoffer raised a point which I think is of interest because it demonstrates a great many principles. He says that the district attorney already has a means of providing immunity in return for testimony. In other words, it just doesn't invest, and that's perfectly accurate. The experience with a testimony like this is that you don't really use it very often for the accomplice. And that kind of finagling or whatever, that can go on when you've got a statute or not. It doesn't matter. But it's real value when you're dealing with the people who have an attitude similar to Representative Skelton, that you are entitled to refuse for whatever reason you may choose, for reasons of personal embarrassment, personal preference, or attitude against the state, or fear, or any whim. And the means by which you do so is by improperly claiming that it's going to incriminate you, and then refusing to testify in the Fifth Amendment. It's that right now that this statute is really helpful. Those are the ones that are difficult to deal with, which is designed.
That's why the summary hearing provision is
included. Yeah. The public interest phrase, I did not research California. I looked quickly over the head notes, and I don't remember any cases about it. That may be because I looked too quickly, and it may be because there weren't any, and I don't remember which. But we felt it was a good idea to stick it in, and the reason is, while there may be some judicial meaning imputed to that phrase, we felt simply that it's simply a good safety net. You can have a district attorney, for example, in a corrupt community, whitewashing his corrupt friends. Such a thing can happen. And to give the judge just a little bit of elbow room somewhere where he sees a real abuse, to step in and stop it, and it didn't seem advisable to try and lift out the possible situations because you can't put you. And essentially what you're doing is giving a judge a little bit of a chance to judge in these cases and without making a decision entirely. So that's why we left in that rather loose indefinite phrase. It's not the requirement of an affirmative finding, such as a public utilities commissioner must act according to public interest, but rather the judge may decline to grant the order if he deems he finds an affirmative not to be in public interest for himself. And it's simply a safeguard against. That's all that I have. The Fifth Amendment, incidentally, was not a product of a fight for liberty and treasure and all that, and will pass some 10 years after the completion of that by 1791.
Any questions? Any questions?
Probably one of the more important questions. The star chamber, did it derive it from the shape of the chamber or from the fact that the ceiling actually had stars?
I don't know.
You're not prepared on your testimony there, are you?
I began mine in 1791.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask a question, are there any cases you've got dealing with the problem of other jurisdictions or other sovereignties, whether the immunity once granted extends to other jurisdictions or fundamental fairness?
That's what Murphy versus Waterson is really all about. It says, of course, this kind of statute is constitutional, but then it goes on to specific objections raised by the defendant in that case. That was an administrative hearing when the witness refused the state administrative hearing, New York and New Jersey. They had a witness before it, they refused to testify. The chairman ordered them to testify, granted them immunity, and he said, I refuse to testify because you cannot grant me immunity under the federal system. And the feds may still prosecute me. Therefore, I refuse to testify rather than to incriminate. And it went through the various appellate levels until it got to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court said, one, the such a statute is constitutional, and specifically it's constitutional over that challenge. It says there would be a real problem if you allowed the state to preclude federal prosecution by granting immunity. Similarly, there would be a real problem if federal people were empowered to grant immunity and preclude the states from prosecuting. And they said that, and also they said this is a valuable tool of law enforcement and criminal justice. And so they resolved it in this manner. They said where one jurisdiction grants immunity, the other jurisdiction, and I'm just going to deal in more detail to what Mr. Johnson said, the other jurisdiction may prosecute such a claim, but if it does, it must come into court and affirmatively prove that none of its evidence is based on the testimony, and that none of its leads and none of its investigation was based upon that testimony. And I think the Attorney General furnished a letter to the committee, if I'm correct. And they've got a quotation. It was in his quote, yes, in his statement or the quotation from Murphy versus Waterson, it says the nub of it, and it really explains that particular dichotomy.
Do you all have that?
Yeah, it's within the statement. Single state portion.
So while that was a matter of state federal, I think that would also be true in regard to say Oregon, Washington, and Oregon, California, Oregon, and the
United States. Any
other questions? I just wanted to be sure that I see this with my own eyes. The Supreme Court said this. I just want to be sure I have it. Do I have a copy of this?
Yes.
The Attorney General's statement, that would be on page 3 of it.
No, thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you. I might say when I was federal, we had much concern about that because we used to deal frequently in corrupt communities. You know, a corrupt district attorney. When they were afraid when they started investigating, they would haul their cronies into court and give them immunity vows, and it would be stalled. And Murphy versus Waterson cleared that up.
That closes the hearing on 1004 will now pick up 1003. You can see right there.
Another hat. This, I think, will be a shorter time. The state's right to appeal in criminal cases is predicated on ORS 138.060, which HB 1003 purports to amend. It provides, as it's presently written, that the state may appeal where there is a judgment for the defendant on a demurrer to the indictment, where there is an order sustaining a plea of former conviction or jeopardy, where there is an order the after trial, arrest and judgment, or an order made prior to trial suppressing evidence. You'll recall that latter provision in the last session. We submitted this bill to amend the demurrer subsection to refer to any order dismissing an indictment prior to trial, and also to allow us to appeal any order granting the defendant's motion for judgment of acquittal, and that be after the state's case is presented. The latter hoped for amendment was stricken by the House, and they approved of the they passed the bill as including the First Amendment, which modifies the demurrer clause. The problem with the demurrer clause is this. The only response to the indictment, other than a plea, which is provided for in by statute, is a demurrer. There's no such thing in our statute as a motion to dismiss. And our appeal statute therefore refers to a demurrer. However, the state cannot preclude the raising of constitutional issues. And motions to dismiss is the vehicle for doing that, whether the statute allows for such a motion or not. And nowadays we find more and more that indictments are not attacked by demurrer, though all they're attacked by motion to dismiss. Even when there are demurrer grounds urged, it's labeled motion to dismiss. And both for constitutional reasons and for any other reason. And we are precluded from appealing any ruling that's made on such an order. When we get into such things as the situation I would like to describe to you in a little bit of detail, such as the case of State versus Speakman at 251 Oregon 259. Let me tell you the facts, because at least in my view, so outrageous. The 1958 decision. The defendant is accused of raping his wife's daughter. He is indicted. A woman's name is on the bottom of the indictment. The defendant comes into court with his lawyer and moves to dismiss on the ground that the name at the bottom of the indictment is the name of his wife, and that she didn't know that she didn't have to testify against her husband, and therefore the grand jury proceedings were unlawful. Mr. Schnaufer?
Very good.
The district attorney representing the state in this case, on the husband. The judge said, your real point is that she was not advised of her constitutional right not to testify against him, and she didn't waive that right. Of course, there is no constitutional right, and advice and waiver is most certainly not required. The statute says that the wife can testify, no privilege in assault against the children. And the district attorney was vainly saying, you can't go behind the indictment, Your Honor. You can't inquire into what happened to the grand jury. The judge sustained the motion to dismiss the indictment, and when Mr. Schnaufer asked, what in the world are we going to do on indictments with man's wife testifies, the judge said, well, you have to then, in those cases, attach an advice and waiver form signed by the witness to the indictment. And we appealed, saying that was, in effect, that dismissal of the indictment is within the four corners of the indictment, and therefore it was in form a demurrer, and we tried to get it reversed. The Supreme Court, with Justice McAllister dissenting, held that it was simply not a demurrer. They could not get to it. They had no jurisdiction to do anything about it, and then in an extraordinary step, they said, but my goodness, the trial judge certainly was wrong. So I went back to the grand jury, they indicted again, and back we the same indictment, and she was recently affirmed. And I might say the appeal in the second case, the defendant's appeal was that he hadn't been given a timely trial because the state appealed the contemporary appeal. Well, we get into those situations, and every time we try and go up, the argument is not on the merits, whether the thing was a demurrer or not. And we simply think there is not that much difference in that the state should have that right. And the experience we've had under subsection 4, and the section 2 years ago, the legislature 2 years ago allowed us to appeal orders suppressing evidence, I suspect would be applicable to this change also. Our experience with that has been that there has not been a multiplicity of appeals. So rather, we get better rulings in the trial court. And the judges are more conscious of the fact that they're going to get appealed either way. And in all candor, they're then inclined to be more careful in their ruling. We've only appealed a couple times in the first 2 years. And I suspect that that would happen to us too. And it is, we have no response. The suspect has ended. As far as the language which is stricken in the House, we would like to see that language restored. I don't think it's quite as important as the other. But when we lose on motions for judgment of acquittal, it's usually simply more angering. Because most frequently these are white collar type. Right. Most people use the white collar type crimes, if I'm really simply for the defendant. And it's very annoying. The other day, the Portland judge took away everything but involuntary manslaughter in the case where the victim was found with a knife in his chest. It's maddening, but there's nothing you can do about it. It's disgusting. We would like to see it restored, but as we're saying, the question is, which one are you really feel strongest about? I have to say,
is that the basis of how it passed the House? You can't have both with your head?
No, of course not.
Well, not what I mean. What was their main argument?
They asked us whether the bill was not deleted, would be acceptable
and do they allow you to share in the reason for deleting that? That's what I mean.
I think, like so many of these questions in criminal law and in the procedure, which you and many of the people in this room have to share, these are frequently gut response subjective questions. There's a feeling, I think, that, well, the fellow has gone in front of the jury once, it's getting more damage. It's not a double jeopardy objection, I don't think, because it's on the defendant's motion, and it is not the right for.
Do you have a question? Yes, I did. Now, I realize you very much appreciate the appeal to the Supreme Court. Was your language intended that on 9-7 to cover an order examining a motion set aside in the judgment? That portion was broad enough to cover that kind of thing, too?
It was designed to be broad enough to include anything which. So you can't go to trial and you can die in this case. We didn't want to say demur or motion to dismiss because we figured somebody, two things, there's no definition of motion to dismiss. Statute. And secondly, that somebody would think of a new label and do a new argument. So we looked for the effect of the order rather than the fact of the law. Second rule is
any other questions? Thank you.
Well, excuse me, everybody probably knows it's me, but on line 10 it refers to 136605. You probably explained that.
That is the statute which provides that at the end of the state's evidence, the defendant may move for a motion for judgment of acquittal. So it would not, in other words, it would not, we didn't want it thought that provision would apply to any other variety of acquittal.
But are there any other kind except you let the jury or the judge say you're not guilty?
No.
Or one or two kinds?
No, but conceivably the order entering the verdict might be considered a judgment of acquittal or something. And that's why we narrowed
it down. So do I understand straight, Mr. Chairman, that the bill as they introduced it gives the state and the person accused the equal chance to the appellate court?
No, this refers only to the state's right to appeal. However,
well, the other guy always got the right to appeal.
Yeah, if he was convicted, then as one assigned of error, when he was appealing the conviction, he can say the court should have granted the motion to judge.
That's what I mean. Doesn't in effect give the state the same right to appeal that the defendant has?
No. No, it doesn't. But the jury finds the defendant guilty.
Oh.
He can't appeal from that. The defendant who's found guilty, he can. They can. So he answers the question.
It's just what the judge does, not what the jury does.
Yes, that's correct.
When I was nodding my head, I meant only on this particular.
Oh. Is Mr. Knopper going to testify on this?
No one is. He's the only witness.
Chairman, Judge Burns from Montgomery County called prior to the meeting, and we suspect he was still, and he wasn't aware that this language had been taken out on line 9 and 10. But he was unable to hear testify today in the first trial. But he wanted to request the right, if the committee was considering it all, restoring the language that was deleted by the House Amendment to submit the statistics in opposition to restoring the language that was deleted by the House Amendment.
In other words, he favors the deletion of
it. If you want to do this today,
that ends the hearing on 1003. Pick up 1125. Austin Crow.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Austin Crow, Chairman of the Oregon State Bar Family and Juvenile Law Committee. This particular bill was drawn up by the committee, presented to the Oregon State Bar, and approved at their annual meeting last fall. The primary purpose of this bill is to provide discretion to the Corrections Division to place in a juvenile training school someone who is over the age of 18 in certain particular instances where perhaps the Corrections Division feels that the maturity, the emotional development, or the psychiatric condition of the particular child would be severely injured or damaged if, in fact, that child, say a girl 19 years of age, was required to go to the adult penitentiary or to OCI. Under those circumstances, they felt that the Corrections Division should have the authority and discretion to send such a child to a juvenile training school rather than to put them in a more adult-type correctional institution. The best case that can be cited for this is a situation where a 19-year-old girl had approximately the mentality of a 14 or 15-year-old child. And she had been arrested and convicted in the state of Wyoming for a misdemeanor, which in the state of Wyoming meant that she had to be held in almost a maximum security institution. She was then transferred by virtue of the interstate compact to the state of Oregon. And at the age of 19, the parents' discretion in the Corrections Division required that she be put into the adult institution for girls. This was such an abhorrent thing to the Corrections Division that they decided that although they didn't have any real statutory authority, that they would put her into Hillcrest School at that particular time. This raised problems as far as they were concerned, as far as a lot of other people were concerned, and it was felt that they should have the discretion to do that, and that is the purpose of this particular statute. As you can see, there was an amendment by the House Judiciary Committee to limit it to people who were under the age of 21 who are committed to the custody of the Corrections Division. Therefore, the statute, as the proposed bill, as amended, limits the persons who can be put into the custody of the Corrections Division and sent to a juvenile training institution to those who are above 18 but under the age of 21. And this amendment is satisfactory and really more clearly states the intent of the committee when the bill was adopted. I should say that the original bill was drafted by the present legislative counsel for the House Judiciary Committee, Mrs. Slagle, who unfortunately was unable to come and testify today because of a hearing before the House Judiciary Committee. If there are any questions that you have regarding this measure, I'd be happy to answer.
And, Austin, how about married girls, 20 years of age, who are adults by reason of our statute?
Well, my answer to that would be that most likely the corrections division would not exercise their discretion under to put somebody who's married in a juvenile family.
Well, that's sort of yes, they'd exercise the discretion perhaps, but it's pretty sloppy legislation, I would think. Because under one of our, I've forgotten, 109, something I believe it is, either male or female who is married reaches the age of majority. And I certainly don't feel that the corrections division would want to be bothered with someone who has reached the age of majority. I would think that this would be amended to provide for unmarried persons under the age of 21 years.
Well, then that would be, we could just replace the word such in the present bill on page 2 and line 15 with unmarried.
Why wouldn't minors work?
They would.
You know what we're talking about? Is that a person?
Of course, depending on what happens to the 18-year-old. We have many of those majors and something going on.
Yeah, but we're gonna be flipped on that anyway.
Yeah. Minors would work, but of course, maybe I'm wrong, and I think that.
Why do you feel that a married person who maybe what I'm thinking of is say this 19-year-old girl in Wyoming had to have had by chance was married there, and she was really not a very confident person. She was married. And her husband had just taken off, and she'd never had anything to do with him again.
Well, then why select 21? Why not 25 to 30? At least with 21, there's a consistency that it applies to minors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the Federal Youth Corrections Act refers to people under the age of 22, and they use that particular age limit. I think it's probably. The concern of the committee was that the arbitrary age of 21 means that somebody at age 21 is not so far distant from the age of the general person within the juvenile training school that they would stand out like a sore thumb, or be just cause more difficulty if they happen to be put in the juvenile training school. Perhaps that was their thinking, that they just used the age of 21 as perhaps a cutoff or anyone's conception of what a juvenile could be.
Well, that's no doubt is true, but I can conceive in situations where a 20-year-old married woman, or a man for that matter, being quite knowledgeable in many affairs of this world, going into McLaren, might have a tendency to bring about more corruption to the others than not.
Well, I was not, unfortunately, present at the work session where that particular provision was added. I was at the hearing when Mr. Slagle presented it to the House Judiciary, and that question did not come up in the hearing. It came up at the work session. As you can see, our bill originally did not have any such legal limitation in there, and I think that I can take no other position but that would be the position of the bar on it. It shouldn't have any legal
limitation. I'll ask this question. I apologize. For missing your early part of your testimony, and I'm going to ask Joe, you haven't testified on this yet, have you?
Well, you may get a chance.
What are we trying to correct? What you alluded to the Wyoming case.
Well,
is this an evil that we're trying to
correct? What we're trying to do is to keep older children who are still within the general concept of what a juvenile is, who's got a juvenile problem, within the jurisdiction of the corrections division, so that they can put that person temporarily or into a juvenile facility rather than putting them into OCI or the penitentiary, as far as the disposition is concerned. And the main problem is that I gather that sometimes you have somebody who is 19 years of age and is going to be transferred to another state subsequently, and you need in some place temporarily to hold them, and that there is no power whatsoever in the corrections division presently to temporarily place somebody into a juvenile training school pending some other further action. Or
because that's not what this says. I mean, that's like the tip of the tail example for a whole horse here, isn't it? I mean, this strikes it clear across the board. You're talking about a detention or a holding type action. I'm trying to agree with Senator Curry that Jenna, who's probably one of the most competent bill drafters we have, I think has missed the boat, and I'm trying to get at what the problem here is. We're extending the juvenile code. I suppose the answer is we need an Oregon State Correctional Institution for the mid-age female is what we got. Is that the problem, Jim?
I don't support it.
Yeah, sir.
Well, yeah, I don't have the same thing up around
there. Unless there's a legal question, I think it's
the code issue that we involve. But we're talking about juveniles, though. Right. Yeah, see, the problem is you can justify a juvenile, 12 to 18, and I wonder why, rather than if it really has merit, if there are some of these kids that shouldn't go, shouldn't that be to 12, 21? That's the effect of hanging on this amendment. Rather than attacking this question head on, and it hooks the amendment on the back end, which probably, I mean, well motivated, but I wonder if it's...
Well,
it's kind of
like a question.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're talking about two different kinds of commitments, too, to the sensory practice of this. One to the juvenile process, chapter 419, and the other is under a state felony kind of conviction, where the person is committed to the sensory practice. So I think step two does more than just tack on a different age. It takes into account a different class of individuals.
Some of them may have been reenacted.
Some of them
are
completely different
courts. That's right. You're in a criminal, in the circuit court, charged with a felony. You're 19 years of age. You're convicted of that. Ordinarily, you go to OCI. They want to say if the emotional maturity or development of this particular child is such that you would benefit more from going to a juvenile training facility, and in the discretion of the corrections division, it would be to the benefit not only of this particular child, but that it would not be to the detriment of all other children there, that it would be a good idea.
All right, the reason I call it tacking on, Mr. Chairman, is because it what it's saying is that the 18-year-old is not a sound place to end or to begin the distinction between being a juvenile and an adult. And I think you're backing in to a, and I don't mean to color the language, if the question is that the 18 is too abrupt, and I perceive what Mr. Flood's talking about, one comes from one court and one comes from the other, but, well, I'm not making myself very clear, and I'm not hung up on the marriage thing either, but I...
Aren't you going to have some other problems, though? Certainly, there's no doubt about it, this affects whoever is juvenile convicted of a crime. We're talking about the case. What he has in mind is someone who has not committed a crime and whose mentality is such that that's where they belong. Don't you then run into the question, husband and wife, how can you, through the juvenile court, someone who has reached the age of majority, assign them here? What right would that husband or the wife, whichever it be, have?
Well, I don't think the bill says that. I don't think the bill authorizes the juvenile court to assign persons above the age of 18. The juvenile commitments are still going to be when it's 18.
What's 419?
We're talking about 137, 124, which is a felony conviction. And this is persons assigned, who would normally be assigned to Oregon Correctional Institution. They are not juveniles. And they would never be within, even under this bill, they wouldn't be within the juvenile system because they're over 18.
The point is then, this has no business in 420. It ought to be in 419, shouldn't it? You shouldn't start out 420.011 except as provided in subsection 2 of this section, because section 1 talks about coming from the juvenile court. There's two ships that pass the night. I think it's part of my problem.
Well, it's confusing.
Yeah, I think there may be a problem that it is kind of...
Well, it's hung on the wrong train. It was...
What train is the right number? That you're going to have juvenile courts committing that person over 18, and that's not going to happen.
Yeah, well, because this is your point, and this is the point I was making, except it's provided in subsection 2 of this section. It says a juvenile court can do it. Well, a juvenile court can't do it.
So then really the language in the first sentence and a half is totally unnecessary.
Well, it seemed to me that if we're not talking about juveniles, get the juveniles out of there. We're talking about a peculiar age group from the ages 18 through 21 or 221. You want a brand new right. You don't want to hook it on. It has nothing to do with juveniles. This is what hung us up. It ought to go right on to 419, which is your general custody one, isn't it, Joe?
Yeah. No, I think it's your 419
is a juvenile code, but your 420 is necessary in order to provide the correctness that is the authority to admit you must. I think that it's proper to use the sub 2 of this statute if you get started with, say, unmarried persons under the age of 21. Maybe assigned to a juvenile training school by the division, with the language in there in reference to ORS 137-1242. I think that would be consistent because 420 talks about the authority of the correction to send people to institutions. And then if you say in 2, just about the adults or the over 18 under 137-1242, it would be consistent. Then you wouldn't have any of the problem that I think is correct.
In other words, make it 420.012 or something. Would that be what you... I know we're straining at that. I don't. I'm not intend to fight this.
I suggest we send it back to House Committee. Can we do that?
Chairman, if I understand this thing at all, if we eliminate the House Amendment, this means that the Corrections Department, when they get a hold of something that doesn't belong in prison, and they may not even belong in Woodburn or Hillcrest, then they put them in a foster home, but they do have the authority. And I think that the age of 21 is completely not fictitious, but it's artificial, as somebody had pointed out earlier. And that's where we're getting into trouble, isn't it? If we take out the House Amendment, then these folks have the authority to do what you think means for that particular plan.
That's why the amendment is coming up, right? To restrict the activity
of the under 21
years of
age. Well, if you're 60, you're not doing your best work.
What would you think of amending 137-124 to add in there, notwithstanding ORS 420.011, if correction condition could do what you want to do under sub 2? Wouldn't that be a more appropriate place to put it? And then you wouldn't get into this confusing problem about
I would think that would probably be a preferable way to do it. And I do have to say that I'm at a disadvantage since Mr. Slade was the one who had done the work on this one. But I think that that's perhaps a more appropriate way to do it.
Do you think you're 21 years on doing that?
They don't want a 50-year-old man going in there under any circumstances.
Well, I don't know. Maybe people might have been
I'd be inclined to maybe not 21, but 25.
I'll talk to Mr. Slade on the south too and explain the problem to her and perhaps
too often find out how hung up they are on 21. Dick doesn't think you ought to have any limit. Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to think you ought to have some limits, but maybe 25?
Yeah, I feel that. In part, and we have gone along looking at the handling and handling of juveniles in the age bracket 12 to 18 with intention around worship to age 21. I think that this is a very valid amendment to this
Well, Mrs. Schlegel had discussed with people in corrections who had told her about the problem that had developed and had requested it. Perhaps they knew something to correct that situation. My own thought would be perhaps it's logical to say that since Oregon has not faced up to the problem of, say, 1825, that that is a legitimate category to be concerned with, and that perhaps you might want to either delete the age limit of 21 or increase it to 25.
I think what Dick is saying, he'd like to delete it. I think I'd be flexible to raise it. On the other hand, if they're hung up on 21, I think it's important we get the 3 years out.
Right.
So I'd rather see it not amended and go for the 3 years. And that's what I thought, maybe you'd kind of send Jenna out and see if they're really stuck on 21, go by 21, and if the house won't buy anything to 21, I think we're hooked.
Well, if correction says 21, I don't kind of do more video about it, but I just think this is not a magic number.
No, I agree with
you. Thank you very much. We have one more. I don't see no one signed up. That was,
you want me to testify?
1331. Do you want to testify?
What is it?
Bill. It says the time limit in which the indictment is found at the arrest in 63 to 30 days. Is anyone here to testify on 1331.
I read about this a long time ago and I can't remember what I read about it. Yes,
Joan, do you have any opinion on this 1331?
What we just talked about?
No.
No.
Many ones. 1331.
Debate. Get notice of it. The reason I'm getting a little gun shy, the House has starting to have a little funny system of having hearings and not advising the senators of the bills being up, and I just hope we're not starting to stand
in front of them. I think it ought to leave the law as it is.
Okay. Well, I'm sure she did.
That'll end the hearing.